They were once more common than white-tailed deer, but now they live only in controlled and managed herds in the United States. Today, bison, why they captivate us, and what their future is. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Artist Michael Wilson has turned his fascination with bison into an art exhibit. Bison, bison, bison. He spent many hours at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge observing the bison there for his paintings. We'll talk about what he saw, and we'll talk about the resident bison at the refuge with wildlife biologist Karen Vista Sparkman. We'll also talk about the future of this species that was once so near extinction with wildlife biologist Lee Jones. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Millions of bison once roamed the plains of North America. The species was hunted to the brink of extinction, and although there are still bison in the United States, they're considered to be ecologically extinct because they don't live as wild animals in their natural habitat. This hour, we're going to talk about these fascinating creatures, their biology, their history, and their future. But first, we're going to start with their ability to capture our imaginations. Urbandale artist Michael Wilson has turned his fascination with bison into an art exhibit, Bison, 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 that will open at the Neil Smith Wildlife Refuge Prairie Learning Center on June 8th. Hello, Michael.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, you're welcome.
So tell me when you first started to be captivated by bison.
Well, in the early, probably the mid-90s, I read a book called Grassland by Richard Manning. And they talked about Neil Smith, and that's where I first learned about Neil Smith and that it was in Iowa. And so I heard in his book that he mentioned that they had bison. So I thought I would go out there, and every year we'd come to the state fair. We'd make a trip out there and go see the bison out there.
What made you want to paint them?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. It was just there was something about them that they're just majestic, and they're kind of scary at the same time. And so I just thought they might be a good subject. I normally paint rural things, traditional subject matter, landscapes and things like that. And I do paint like draft horses, workhorses, you know, farm-related paintings like that. So I think just that size, the immense size, and of course it's an American icon. So it just caught my attention.
When you look at bison, there's something about them because they're not a part of our natural landscape anymore. Do you feel a connection to our past when you see them?
Yeah. A lot of people do see some nostalgia in some of my artwork, but I call it more like ancestry because my family has been farmers for generations coming from Massachusetts and on through. As each territory would open up, they would move further west. So I think I have that kind of sense of place where, you know, the prairie and that's the natural animal that was on the prairie. So, I do have a sense of, like, ancestry with that. I feel a little connection that way.
When you decided that you wanted to paint them, did you think about going out west and seeing the larger herds in Yellowstone in South Dakota, or did you just want to study the ones that were here in Iowa?
Yeah, I considered that for like a couple seconds, and I thought, well, you know, I'm from Iowa, and I kind of like Midwest things. I'm very plains-oriented, and so I thought, you know, I'm just going to do the ones here. And a lot of people would say that. When I would tell them about the project, they would say, oh, you should go to South Dakota. I mean, I've had people say that every time I talk about the project. And I thought to myself, you know, I want to do the ones that the bison here, because actually they're in South Dakota because, you know, we've plowed up everything here. But they are pretty native to this area. So that was my connection. I thought, you know, let's just do it here. Let's do it here.
How long did you spend on this project?
I started in June of last year. I had the idea to paint them, so I approached Neil Smith, and I said, you know, I'm thinking about doing an exhibit. And my goal was a year in the life. I wanted to do 1 year in all seasons and all stages of life of the bison exclusively at that refuge.
How did you go about doing that? How much time did you spend out there?
Yeah, actually spent, I got a new respect for the National Geographic photographers because, you know, it's basically like a stakeout. You know, you just go, and I think I made up to 50 trips out there from my home in Urbandale, and just go out there and park in the bison compound and just sit and watch them and observe them because I really didn't know too much about them. So I thought, well, the best way would be to buy a field guide from the bookstore at the refuge and just kind of read about their tendencies and things and then observe them. So it was just, it was like a stakeout. In fact, sometimes my wife and I, we would have like a Saturday night date night, and we would drive out to the refuge and sit there, and I have a Honda Element, so I could pop out the moonroof, and I'd stand there like I was in a turret, and she would just drive the compound, go back and forth, and kind of chase them down.
Did you photograph them so that you could capture these images?
Right. I work from reference photographs, so I would take about 200 pictures each visit, sit out there for a couple hours, and then I would go back to the studio and look through them and try to do some sort of composition from that. And then draw out, you know, sketch out a plan. And then I then do a smaller oil study just to kind of get the temperature and the values and the composition. And then scale that up to the larger painting.
Once you had read about them and knew a little bit more about bison, were there specific behaviors that you were hoping to see?
Yeah, there was a... of course, the one that really appealed to me was the bison in a rut, you know, that fierce battle between the bulls. And I also wanted to catch them in the snow with the snow falling down and things like that. And then, of course, you know, the some of the other behaviors like calving and grazing and loafing aren't that, you know, exciting. But that's what they do most of the time.
Did you see everything you wanted to see?
No, I didn't. In fact, I kind of wanted to get a stampede. You know, we all have that kind of dances with wolves image in our mind. And I didn't really catch that. There was one time you can go out there and you can sit and watch them. And mostly they're just eating and loafing and moving. But there aren't any predators out there, so they don't really, like, stampede. But there's one time that I was sitting out there, and I was probably out there an hour. And there was a thunderstorm coming. And there was lightning and dark clouds, and it just started raining. And for whatever reason, the bison herd just took off running, and they were running with the lightning. It was amazing. But they were so far away that I couldn't zoom in on them. But they do a lot of things. They do a lot of pawing and horning, and they do different calls. So there's some of those things that I didn't catch, but I was really happy with what I did.
I've been looking at just a few of your paintings, and there's a painting of a nursery setting where there are a lot of the calves together. Is that something that you got to observe, the calves coming together so that just a few adults could keep an eye on them?
Right, yeah. When they are calving, the cows are pretty protective, so they tend to stay away from the road. But there are some times where you can kind of sneak up on them. And, of course, when you're in the compound, you have to stay on the road. So I kind of drove the outskirts of the compound and would zoom in on some of the calves playing together. And basically they mimic the adults, and they, you know, they wallow. They kind of roll around in the dust, and they do calls and things like that.
You became a little bit infatuated with the bachelor.
Yeah.
The bachelor bulls. Tell me about them.
Yeah, I kind of felt bad for him. He was... basically, the bachelors are males that are, you know, old enough and not viable to fight the younger males for to reproduce. So they just kind of seclude themselves, and it kind of has like a, to me, it had like a lonely kind of melancholy vibe. Like, you know, kind of their life is over. You know, their lives are over, and so they just kind of hang out by themselves, and they're very happy to be secluded. But when I painted them, I tended to get like this melancholy kind of feel from him.
Did you feel like, I know you had to stay quite a distance away. You were in a vehicle, so
right,
you weren't too close to them. But did you feel like you connected with any of the individuals?
No, not really. There are certain ones that you recognize, but no, not particularly. I guess I didn't see them that often to where I could, like, pick out certain ones. I'm not trained, so I was just observing.
Do you have a favorite painting from all the ones that you've done?
Oh, geez, that's like asking for a favorite kid. There's favorite places in each painting where I thought, ooh, I got that horn pretty good or something like that. But probably not a favorite painting.
You mentioned that you wanted to see them in the snow, but you had a hard time finding that, right?
Yeah. Well, I had a self-imposed year. I said I want to catch them in all stages of life in a year. So we had a pretty dry year last year. So there was a snowstorm between Christmas and New Year's, and it was pretty rough. It was kind of a blizzard. But I thought, well, I'm going to go out to the refuge and see if they had plowed through through to the bison compound. And so it was kind of rough driving, but I did go out there, and I kind of sat on top of the hill right before you go down the hill into the bison compound. And I was just sitting there, and the snow was blowing, and it was pretty deep. And I thought, boy, if I could just see them over the hill, you know, and they were right next to the road. And so before I knew it, I was down into the compound, and I parked, and I just took a flurry of pictures. And so I did get the snow picture before the end of the year.
And I saw one of the paintings, Christmas Eve Dinner. Did you do more than one painting in the snow?
Yeah, I actually have two paintings that I'm going to have in the exhibit, but I actually did more paintings. But those turned out really nice, where I think one of them was the bachelor. He's just kind of standing in the snow. And like I said, the reason I titled him Christmas Eve Bachelor was because that kind of added to the melancholy of, like, he was kind of celebrating Christmas by himself. And the other ones, I think there was a group of two or three, but yeah, it was amazing to watch him in the snow, just moving that snow back and forth, trying to look for grass. It was amazing.
When people see your paintings, what do you want them to feel?
Well, just, I guess what I felt, I'm trying to convey just that respect, the healthy respect that I have for them. When I started to do the paintings, you know, art tends to have like a certain amount of introspection. And so I started journaling about why I liked bison, tried to find out why. And I had remembered that the very first photograph I had ever taken was of a bison. And my family and I were on the All-American vacation out in South Dakota, and my dad and I had the opportunity to go down into a herd in an open Jeep. And so him and I went down through there, and I saw this one lone bison standing on the hill. I'm sure he was a bachelor. And I had borrowed my sister's camera, and I pleaded with her. I was about 10 years old. And I said, can I take your camera? And I think I took the whole roll of that one bachelor. And so later, of course, you know, we drove right down into the herd. But I, driving through the herd in that open Jeep was just amazing. Like, they parted like the Red Sea, and it was terrifying and exciting at the same time.
And stayed with you.
It stayed with me.
Well, stay with us. We will continue our conversation in just a moment. With me right now is Urbandale artist Michael Wilson. His art exhibit, Bison, 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 will be opening at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge Prairie Learning Center on June 8th. In a moment, we're going to talk more about the biology and science and future of these creatures. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about bison. We've been talking about a new art exhibit that will be opening at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge Prairie Learning Center on June 8th. But now we're going to talk about the bison who are featured in those paintings by Urbandale artist Michael Wilson. Michael is still with us, but he painted the bison that live at Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge. And with us now is Karen Visti Sparkman. She is the wildlife biologist at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge. Hello, Karen.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
How many bison live at the wildlife refuge?
Right now we have, latest count anyway, we had 10 calves so far this year, and we have 55 non-calves, so yearlings and older.
And what is your size limit? This is a limited space, so you can't just let the herd grow like it would naturally. But how many bison can you support?
Well, we're trying to keep this size of the herd pretty small, so we'll probably keep it about the size it is now for a while. After the calves, we'll see how many calves we have, and then we'll reduce the herd in the fall by removing some of the animals.
Why is it important, do you feel, to have bison at the Prairie Preserve?
Well, the main point of our refuge is to restore and reconstruct natural ecosystems, and tallgrass prairie is the biggest one in Iowa, and bison are a big part of the tallgrass prairie ecosystem.
How? What do they do for the prairie?
Well, they, you know, the ecosystem includes everything that lives in a prairie and the soil and water and everything. So bison are, you know, just part of it. But the prairie plants themselves benefit from being grazed by bison, especially since bison really prefer to eat grasses instead of the forbs or wildflowers in the prairie. So they, by eating the grasses, that gives the other plants an advantage. They get more light and water available to them so they can grow. And so it increases the diversity of the plants.
In their natural habitat, bison are always on the move. So they don't overgraze an area like cattle can. But of course, at the wildlife refuge, you do have to contain them. Is that a danger that they could overgraze the area?
Yeah, that's why we have to be careful about our population levels. We have about 800 acres where they are in the enclosure. So we just have to keep monitoring them and see how the prairie is doing and see how the bison are doing.
Of course, these are wild animals, but what kind of role do you have in making sure they stay healthy and cared for throughout the year?
Yeah, we try to keep them as wild as possible and treat them like wildlife because they are. But since they can't go anywhere and there aren't any natural predators in Iowa then for bison, then they can't really maintain themselves as well. So we just have to keep checking on them. We check their body condition and their health. And if somebody is injured, we'll just try to keep an eye on them if there's problems. Generally, we don't treat them with any veterinary treatment, except we will step in and euthanize if it looks like the animal is suffering.
Do you feel that the herd, the size that it is now and the amount of space that they have, do you feel like they get to do everything that a herd in the wild would get to do?
For the most part, I mean, they, you know, a herd in the wild, historically, when prairie covered the whole central part of the United States, they could roam for miles and miles and miles. So they can't really roam like they could. They have everything they need there. There's food and water, and they can interact. They fight and reproduce and do all the things that bison do.
Now, of course, visitors have to stay in their cars and not go near the bison. Do you go near them?
Well, I generally not. I can go off the road in a vehicle, but I try not to stay out of my vehicle when I'm near the bison because they are dangerous. They can be. They're just unpredictable, so you don't know what they're going to do. And there's been some scary moments when I was out, even just in a little UTV out with them, where it feels a little scary. But
can you give me an example?
Well, just checking on the bison. I have to go out periodically every week or two. I try to get out and get close to them. And during the rut, when the males are chasing each other, they don't really pay attention to anything else.
And they're big.
Yeah, they are big. And they'll go after each other. And yeah, there's just been times I was pretty close to that and just got out of the way.
Do you identify individuals? Do you keep an eye on specific bison throughout the year?
There are some that are identifiable, but, you know, some mark with, you know, something with their horns is a little different. We do have them microchipped, so when we do the roundup, we can actually identify each individual at that time.
And how do you round them up?
Well, we use vehicles to chase them into the corral. We usually try baiting them first with hay, and so, you know, they're attracted to that, and salt. And then If they don't all go in, then we'll kind of herd them in with vehicles. We try to just move them in slowly and not make them run, but sometimes they'll run anyway.
Do they tend to stick together?
Yeah, for the most part, the family group includes the cows and the calves and young animals. The bulls, like Michael was talking about, will kind of separate off into small groups or individuals. But once they they do tend to kind of want to stick together.
Well, and I know they're not deer, but deer tend to yard up in the winter and then separate in the spring. Do they have a cycle like that?
Not as much. It's more whether it's the breeding season or not, with during the rut that the bulls will be fighting, and some of the younger bulls will start challenging the older bulls and try to get in on the action.
During the calving season, do the bulls have anything to do with the calves?
Nope. Nope. Not really.
They just stay away.
Yeah.
And the cows probably prefer it that way.
Yeah, but. Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to bring another wildlife biologist into this conversation as well. I'm talking with Karen Visti Sparkman. She is the wildlife biologist at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge. And Lee Jones is with us on the line. She is a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service based in Bozeman, Montana. Hello, Lee.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And I want to, we've been talking about this particular herd in Iowa, but let's go back in time a little bit. Of course, we all know that bison were hunted almost to extinction. They are not extinct in the United States, although they are, some people consider them to be ecologically extinct because they live in managed herds. But tell me, when the bison almost disappeared, how did they come back? Where did those bison come from?
It's actually a really, really neat story, because it is easy to look and say how many of our federal herds that we have established, both within the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Park Service, but those federal herds were largely created after several private individuals, ranchers, actually went out into that very tiny, maybe just 1,000 bison left. And a bunch of these ranchers went out and gathered up a handful of calves from here and gathered up a handful of calves from there. So several private herds were established in the very late 1800s in states like Montana, Nebraska, Kansas, Texas, South Dakota. And several of these private folks eventually did provide animals between 1902 and 1919 to establish the six kind of original founder federal herds that we have existing today. And, of course, several herds were established in the 40s through the 60s, and, of course, Neil Smith in 1996. But the really neat thing is the geographic difference between where these herds were started. So in Montana, there might have been a couple of hundred little bison remaining out of that 1,000 on the Great Plains. And so a handful of calves were captured from the wild and brought into captivity in Montana, in Texas or Kansas. So because these private ranchers started these little herds scattered all across the Great Plains, we captured at least a little bit more of the genetic diversity that was present in that giant millions large original herd that we had before 1700.
So you have the genetic diversity from that, but there's also a problem with the genetics of bison because of these ranchers as well, right?
Well, we know that if you go from 30 to 50 million bison down to 1,000, that's what we call a bottleneck. You can imagine the tremendous amount of genetic diversity that we must have lost. So diversity is the most important thing that we take into consideration for management. Diversity means differences in genetics. Longer horns, short horns, longer hair, short hair. The variety that you see in their bodies, in their behavior, in their reproduction, maybe even in their ability to digest tall grass prairie or short grass prairie. We know that differences in these genetics is really important in species conservation. So we certainly are faced with a challenge.
There was also interbreeding between cattle and bison as well, right?
There certainly was, and that was an issue that we really didn't know a whole lot about until a study was done back around, I think it was about 2003, and a few smaller studies prior to that. But hybridization or integration is a really complex, controversial topic. We're still learning a lot about it. We do know that almost all federal herds have a very small amount of domestic cattle hybridization, and we're talking less than 0.5% on average. We also know that since we are probably very short on diversity relative to what it takes to conserve a species long into the future, that we really do need to focus on that diversity. Geneticists have overwhelmingly told us that diversity is the most important, and if we can work to reduce that cattle hybridization over the long term, we certainly strive towards that goal, but only if we're really confident we've got that diversity conserved first. So there's ongoing studies. We really don't have a clear picture. We do know that most federal herds have a very tiny amount of cattle gene hybridization. We don't have the final numbers of exactly how much that we have, but we know it's a very small amount, less than 1%.
Christy, tell me about the herd at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge, because as Lee mentioned, it was founded in 1996, but you've had a fairly major turnover of the animals in the herd.
The herd at Neil Smith, we just switched out the herds in 2006, so we did have a different herd originally that was made up of bison from several different refuges originally. And we decided that after this genetic study was started, they decided that the refuge wasn't really contributing to the genetic diversity. And so we have, so we got this herd from the National Bison Range, which included some genetic material that wasn't found in any other herds. So we wanted to just be sure it was protected in more than one location.
What happened to the bison that were there before 2006?
We donated them to some Native American tribes and also to, I think, a county conservation board.
What happens every year maybe you don't cull the herd every year, but as the herd grows, you want to keep it at a certain size. What happens to the bison that you cull out of the herd every year?
We generally have been donating them to Native Americans. They use them for, some of the tribes use them for, to improve their diet, to return to a more traditional diet and connect with their past, I guess.
Lee, this herd at the Neil Smith Wildlife Refuge is obviously very special here in Iowa. The fact that they are living on native prairie grasses is very special. Do you see nationwide, is there a growing trend of places that are making room for bison?
Well, I can certainly tell you that nationwide there's a growing trend in having that conversation and that discussion. Obviously, within the Fish and Wildlife Service, we don't have the ability to run out and establish large new bison herds. We certainly can't create a bison herd with 1,500 or 2,000 animals. That takes an awful lot of acres. Most acres in North America are already claimed or are being used. But there are some groups that are working towards the long-term increase of bison in terms of overall numbers and towards the long-term restoration of bison ecologically, having them cover large, large areas of land. Obviously, that's very controversial, but I would say the conversation has definitely been started.
What makes it so controversial?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, if you have large areas of land that bison cover, I don't know if you've ever seen what a bison can do to landscaping, to a haystack. Certainly not something you want to encounter standing in the middle of the interstate at night. They also are, they can exclude cattle from some of those areas. We humans have a pretty good claim on most of our acres in this country. So it's difficult to find those very, very large landscapes that it would take to ecologically restore bison.
It also sounds like it's not necessarily something that the general public would be willing to do.
Tolerance of wildlife anywhere that you go is incredibly variable. Obviously, in some areas in the Rocky Mountains, we tolerate grizzly bears and wolves. Some areas don't tolerate elk or deer in certain areas. So obviously, there are boundaries. Some of them are fences. Some of them are highways. Some of them are more administrative or political boundaries, where we as humans make decisions where our wildlife should or should not be.
Why do you think it could be important to restore them ecologically? What's the difference?
Well, first of all, I mean, you kind of ask your question, why did we save them as a species in the first place? I'll put that question back out. Is our long-term ultimate goal of bison conservation to have them in small herds? Is our ultimate goal of establishing a bunch of zoos around the country, really? And so there's going to be a lot of different answers to that question, depending on who you ask. You know, you would like to think that we are doing a better job of managing our wildlife today than we did 100 years ago. And you would hope that we'll continue to do a better job in the future. And what defines a better job and how that applies to bison as a species, I think, is we're just starting that conversation as a country.
We'll continue our conversation in a moment. We're talking about bison today on Talk of Iowa. With me, Lee Jones. She's a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service based in Bozeman, Montana. Karen Visti Sparkman is here. She is the wildlife biologist at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge, responsible for the bison herd there. And also with me is Michael Wilson. He's an Urbandale artist who has a new exhibit opening of his paintings of the bison at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about bison. This conversation was sparked by a new art exhibit that will be opening at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge Prairie Learning Center on June 8th, called Bison, Bison, Bison by Urbandale artist Michael Wilson. And he is with me also, Karen Visti Sparkman. She is the wildlife biologist at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge. And Lee Jones, wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service based in Bozeman, Montana. You're welcome to join our conversation as well. If you have questions about these creatures, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. What place do you think they should have in the United States, in North America? Do you think they can live as wild creatures again? 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Our email address, again, is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to return again to this herd in Iowa, Karen. When people come to the refuge, I know that the bison can be difficult to see. What do you think their role is in educating the public?
Well, part of the role they serve at Neil Smith is to bring people out to visit. And a lot of people might not get too excited about going out to see some prairie, but they go out to see bison and they see prairie at the same time. So we hope to teach people about the role of bison in prairies and just about prairies and how they're a historical part of our landscape here in Iowa.
Well, and Michael, I keep mentioning the name of your exhibit, which sounds like you're just really, really excited about bison.
Yeah.
But that's actually
well,
the scientific name, right?
Yeah, actually, it's the scientific name for the subspecies, the plains bison.
All right.
Yeah, when I saw that, I thought, well, that's pretty cool because, you know, it's like emphasis.
Right, right. It feels like it should have exclamation points.
Right, it's like bison, bison, bison.
Well, Lee, what do you think? I mean, when the public encounters a herd of bison, and again, it is, they're exciting creatures to see. They almost feel prehistoric in some ways because they aren't something that is a part of our environment today, and they do connect us with our past. What do you want people to take away from an encounter?
Well, I tell you, I don't know that you could say there's something people need to or should take away, but as Michael was talking earlier, they command respect. If you ever hear them, it will take your breath away, the power and the sound that they make. I mean, I do genetics, and they still take my breath away every day. And
we tried to capture some sound, but it's very hard to get.
They're not going to be cooperative.
do you have an impression that you do for
no,
people?
No, no. I will tell you that it is absolutely one of the things that makes me laugh the most.
Yeah.
Is when you hear cows and calves call back and forth, because the cow has such a deep, majestic. And the calf sounds a little bit like a young squawky goose. And, so you just can't help but they command amazing respect and power, and yet they also have the ability to make you laugh. And as Michael said, you know, looking at the bachelors does give you a sense of loneliness, melancholy. But you have to keep in mind as well that some of our genetic work suggests that those bulls do occasionally sneak out on a date night themselves.
So, well, that's good to hear. That's encouraging.
It is hilarious because we never used to know that, and we spent decades as scientists trying to figure that out, and we'd sit on our buns with binoculars and look. And apparently they sneak out on date night occasionally. So they do contribute genetically to our herds, even though they might not let you be aware of that. They like being majestic and alone and proud.
Well, and that would keep them out of the competition. And the competition for mates can be really fierce, right?
Absolutely. And we do have animals that obviously there's a lot of behavioral show type deal, but animals do actually kill each other. And that is part of the system. That's part of the natural fight for dominance. And that's one of the things that we do ensure occurs at all of our herds, all of our refuges, no matter how many acres they have, how small. That's an important part of keeping bison bison, keeping what they used to be and what we hope to keep them as for hundreds of years to come. That's part of what they are, is that fight, that aggression.
Have you witnessed that at the Neil Smith Refuge, Karen?
Yes, definitely there's fighting, and we've had some animals kill each other. And one of the sounds that I just enjoy is when the bulls are rutting, and they almost sound like a lion growling or roaring. They'll make incredible noises.
They're really a bellow.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds a lot like sometimes they'll walk by the vehicle when I was parked out there, and they look funny at the same time scary, but because they stick their tongue out. And their stomach will heave up, and then it sounds like just weird growl, but it's like you're doing it inside an empty 50-gallon, you know, drum. It's just this big sound, and you can feel it. You can physically feel it and hear it. It's just it's very impressive.
It's like turning the bass up on a stereo. You can feel it. It's a very deep resonance.
Yeah, when the stereo is too loud in the car next to you at the stoplight, and it's like boom, boom, boom. But yeah, it's
that's
just
a bison.
Yeah.
Lee and Karen, I want to ask both of you, and I know that you're scientists, and I know that you work hard not to anthropomorphize or give human characteristics to the animals that you observe, but these creatures are so inscrutable. I mean, they're so big, and it's hard to, when you just observe them casually, to really see behaviors. How much individuality do you see in bison? Do you want to start, Lee?
Well, we certainly do see individuality, but it certainly takes quite a bit of time to figure that out. Over the years doing work with different animals, you certainly see some animals are a little bit more tolerant of human approach than others. You certainly see that some animals are going to be a little more tolerant of cars than others. I'm sure if Karen goes out and does her checks on the animals throughout the year, she probably has a good idea. Oh, boy, that young bull is just incredibly curious. And if I see him pick his head up and head this direction, young bulls in general are curious. 2 or 3 year olds, they may not hurt you, but they might get really close, and it's not a very comfortable place to be. So there certainly is some. And, you know, they are different, just like any other animal.
Karen?
Yeah, I guess I can pick out a few individuals that, yeah, they'll behave a little differently, or they'll look a little differently, and yeah, they're individuals.
Now, when the cows are caring for their young, is that something that they do only for one season, or do they maintain a relationship with their calf through time?
Is that one for me?
Sure, either one of you.
I can jump in, too. We do have studies from other herds and radio telemetry studies that suggest that that can be variable. A lot of calves will hang with mom and stick with mom at least until she has another calf that following year. Let's say if it's an older cow, she may not have a calf that following year, so sometimes that first calf will hang out with mom for a couple of years. As the animals age, as that youngster grows up and starts to be a mom herself or start to be a big bachelor bull, those associations decrease with time. But there certainly is definitely some family relationships that occur from an animal's birth on up for the first couple of years.
Well, and I know, Karen, you're working on genetic diversity, but is there a sort of a family structure to the herd?
Well, it's just the family group in general. That's the, like I said, mostly the cows and calves and younger animals and a bull or two. But they'll hang out together. So it's basically one big family. and then the bulls that come and go from the herd. So they're their own family. And I think they're pretty willing to accept other animals into it. Last year we had a cow that died and her calf survived and just became incorporated into the herd, and a yearling kind of took him in and he followed her all around for the rest of the summer. So
did another cow nurse the calf?
No, he just got weaned prematurely. Oh. He was about 2 months old, but he survived.
With the
little bugger.
with the sort of babysitting groups, the nursery groups that you'll see with a bunch of calves, do the mothers ever share duties, Lee?
Oh, they certainly do. You don't see frequently cross nursing, but you certainly do see as the calves are born and they start to get strong enough to play. It's just hilarious to watch because you'll get four or five of them running around bunches and they're doing laps around each other and laps around mom and. Sometimes a couple of those cows will graze off a little bit further, and the youngsters get to bug the babysitter for a little while.
We have a couple of questions from George in Grinnell. He wants to know the difference between the plains buffalo and the bison up in Canada. And maybe, Lee, you could break it down a little bit further for us and talk about the different genuses in the United States and in North America.
Well, that's actually a really interesting question because we do believe genetically that there was a completely distinct subspecies of the wood buffalo, and they definitely have some morphological body shape differences. We think there were some behavioral differences. There has been, and this is another word for hybridization or integration, we actually have had a lot of crossing of the plains bison and the wood bison to the point where a lot of plains bison were put into Canada to help restore bison in Canada. We thought we were doing a really good thing, and in the end we ended up probably swapping out a lot of the genetics of the original wood bison up there.
So basically the two distinct groups have come together then now.
We do believe that there's certainly some differences, but what's really fun is how do you define a subspecies or a species? How do you draw that line? And that's a challenge genetically. And of course, taxonomically, we used to do it all the time, but then when you look at genetics, we figured out that we weren't always right on that. And in fact, we talked about the cattle hybridization earlier. Bison and domestic cattle are in a different genus.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, they're not supposed to be able to interbreed, and they don't actually do it very well.
Right. Well, I know that the ranchers were hoping that they would do it very well, and there would be this wonder creature called the beefalo, but that didn't really work out, right?
Yeah, beefalo or cattalo, right. And it actually has worked out. Believe it or not, there are still cattalo and beefalo associations in North America, but it takes a lot of work. they're not what you would call very genetically compatible.
Well, and you mentioned the bison in Canada. There are actually places in Canada where they are not ecologically extinct. There are wild bison in Canada?
Absolutely. It's interesting because a lot of folks refer to Yellowstone and think that's, you know, a wild free-roaming herd is. And while they certainly don't have a fence, they do have political and administrative boundaries that once they cross, they are not allowed past that point. and maybe managed through hunting or agency culls. Canada has done things a little bit differently. A lot of their herds, not all of them, but they do have some what you would consider more free-ranging herds, where there's kind of this zone in which they are controlled. And again, it's a line. They're controlled or managed through hunting or agency removal. But a lot of those herds do really roam much more freely than we allow any of our bison to here in the United States.
Is that just because the population in Canada is more sparse in those places?
I think you'd have to ask the Canadians why and how that,
we'll get
that
some
system
Canadians
has evolved.
So do you know enough about the Canadian herds to know if there are conflicts between people and bison?
Oh, there definitely are conflicts. And we also know that some of the Canadian herds, because there's a lot of movement and there's not quite as aggressive management like, you know, at Neil Smith, we do handle the animals each year. We do disease testing. We check for body condition health. We do also, some of the Canadian herds do have some pretty significant diseases as well, brucellosis, some of those types of things that are a problem that can become entrenched in wildlife. And when you have a herd that isn't fenced and isn't handled every year, then managing those diseases becomes more challenging. And that is a flip side or a downside to how some of the more free-roaming herds are managed, which is probably part of the political challenges with having bison roam more freely in the United States. We do know that the Yellowstone herd has some brucellosis. Nobody wants that.
We have one more question. This is from Marilyn in Perry. I remember an incident at a prairie managed by Kansas State University north of Manhattan, Kansas. The prairie has a herd of bison. After a wildfire on the prairie, a graduate student whose job it was to herd the bison away from the fire reported that the animals did not panic and run away from the fire, but walked right through that fire to safety on the other side. Have you ever heard of this type of behavior?
Yeah, when we burn at the refuge at Neil Smith, the bison don't really care. We've had fire surrounding a herd as we lit along the edges, and there were some of the bulls were in the middle, and they just kind of sat there and eventually just walked through it. I mean, it wasn't a very roaring fire because in the areas they graze, there's less vegetation to burn. But yeah, they seem to be curious too, and sometimes they'll come over and investigate.
And we have a final thought. This is from Debbie in Washington. The guests have talked about the raw force of bison, which is absolutely true when you see them up close. But my favorite memory of being in a bison reserve was seeing a mother bison nursing her calf in a quiet area of the reserve. The calf was so playful, and the mother had to knock it away a few times to get it back into shape. That's something I will never forget. And there is a lot to see when you watch a herd of bison. I guess, Michael, you learned that firsthand.
Yeah, exactly. You know, as I would go out there and spend 2 hours just sitting, you know, turn off the car, turn off the radio, and just, you know, listen to the wind go through the vehicle and just, you know, watching them, you know, I would sit for 2 hours where, you know, the refuge gets a lot of traffic and people would drive through and stop for 2 minutes, and then they would just, you know, move on. Where, you know, I would sit there for 2 hours, and I think that takes off some layers.
Yeah, your patience was rewarded.
Right, and then I think you asked earlier, you know, do we need them? And just as a citizen, I would say, yeah. I mean, they give us a sense of place, and the more that you know, the more that we know who we are, you know, we want to protect it, and so I would say yes, we do need them.
Michael Wilson, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Urbandale artist Michael Wilson, his art exhibit Bison, Bison, Bison will open at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge on June 8th. Karen Visti-Sparkman, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Karen Visti-Sparkman is the wildlife biologist at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge. And Lee Jones, thank you very much.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Lee Jones, wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Talk of Iowa is produced by Sarah Bowden, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins.